The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Brendan O'Neill is the editor of Spiked Online and a columnist for The Big Issue and Reason. In this episode, we discuss how Spiked started off as a Marxist publication and where it's ended up. In this episode, you'll hear Husalonia's Everybody Should Stop Doing Everything, an excerpt from The Fix's One Thing Leads to Another, Noam Chomsky describing the problem of free will, and Captain Kirk. The music you're listening to right now is a theme for Barney Miller, and it's being played in tribute to Abe Vigoda. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Brendan O'Neill and I discuss how to hang on to bourgeois liberty. As well as being the editor of Spiked, Brendan is also a columnist for The Big Issue and Reason. He writes widely for a variety of other publications, including The Telegraph, The Spectator, and The Australian. He is the author of some books, most recently a book called A Duty to Offend, Selected Essays. Brendan O'Neill, welcome to Zero Squared.
Hi, Doug.
Hey. So we're going to be talking about freedom of speech today and Spiked, but I wanted to start off by asking you about your publication, about Spiked. My understanding is that Spiked is Marxist or started off as a Marxist publication.
That is correct. Spiked is about 15 years old. We're a daily, current affairs, radical, some say contrarian publication. We cover politics and all sorts of things. And we grew out of a magazine called Living Marxism, which was a print magazine, which was closed down in a notorious libel trial in London in the late 1990s. So we have Marxist origins. We still refer to ourselves, well, some of our authors refer to themselves as Marxist libertarians, which some people think is a contradiction in terms, which I think only shows that they don't really understand anything about Marxism. So I guess you could call us left-wing, left-leaning libertarians, but I'm not sure that the terms left and right mean much these days. When you have people on the right fighting for freedom of speech, an issue they were never, ever interested in before, and you have people on the left demanding restraints on economic growth, something that they would never have done in the past, you do start to wonder, do these terms really mean anything anymore?
I think the term Marxist still, or maybe just the writings of Marx still means something, but I'm not sure about even the term Marxist. But it seems to me that what the publication has ended up being is more classically liberal or aiming at just holding on to Enlightenment values rather than Marxist. Is that correct, you think?
Yeah, I think we are definitely worried about the state of Enlightenment values in the West, particularly in Europe, and we're very keen to defend them, to articulate them, to argue for them as publicly and loudly as possible. So it's almost like I think things have changed so much, and the left-right divide has kind of corroded in such an intensive way that it's almost like we have to go back even further. Back to those French revolutionary ideals where the whole idea of left and right comes from, where, you know, those who sat on the left right of the assembly and those who sat on the right side of the assembly. We almost have to go back to that and say, well, what was that about? What values were those people fighting for? How much of an impact did those values have on the world? And it's that kind of sentiment that we want to defend now, I think.
This is sort of depressing in a way, if you have like a Marxist position, because Marx saw that the bourgeois Enlightenment values were good, but that there were contradictions in the economy so that they were difficult or to next to impossible to realize. And that Marx's whole critique would say, yes, we need to use reason and to create a better world, but reason is always constrained by the economy, and we have to change the foundation of society if we hope to really be able to be living through an actual enlightenment or having our reason guide our society.
Yeah, and of course, in order to do that, you need a leadership and a mass movement and a revolutionary sentiment, and none of those things exist now. I'm really fascinated by the kind of the way in which Marx has come back into fashion. You know, all these hipsters are rushing out to buy Marxist texts so they can understand why the poor black man lives on the street at the end of their road. And it's like it's Marxism without any proletariat, without any revolutionary masses. It's safe to like Marx now because the revolutionary component of Marxism is just non-existent. There is no possibility that there will be a violent overthrow or a radical reimagination of economic life. So it's safe to like Marx. And I really dislike the way that Marx's work has been kind of marshaled to the cause of this kind of modern day fatalism and miserabilism. And, you know, we all know that capitalism is so evil and so horrible. And Marx tells us that all the optimism and the revolutionary spirit and the idea that humanity could grow even more and have an even larger human footprint on the planet, those great things about Marxism have been pushed to one side. Now everyone embraces Marx as a sign that, you know, well, basically humanity is a bit crap after all. So I don't like what they're doing with Marx.
Well, I completely agree with you there. But I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. I don't know if it's too relevant, but until around 2008, late 2008, after the economic crisis, I considered myself to be some sort of anarchist.
And
I was the kind of person that would pick up Adbusters and read magazines.
Oh,
yeah. But then the economic crisis happened, and I picked up Adbusters, and they were advocating for unemployment. And I thought, you know, wait a minute, hold on a second. I kind of need a job, and I think most of my friends need jobs. And I can understand the critique of consumerism, but this depression that seems to be on the horizon is no revolutionary force. You know, this is not going to. So I started to ask the question, why is this happening? What do I need to rethink? And Marx becoming popular again was something I picked up.
Well, the thing is, the thing that I've been writing about and lots of people at Spiked have been writing about for 15 years now is the left-wing fashion for austerity, environmental austerity. You know, we have to make do and mend. We can't have any more economic growth because it's bad for the environment. It's bad for people's mental health. It makes people overly competitive. I mean, for the past more than 15 years, in fact, but for the past few decades, the left has mainstream the idea that economic growth is damaging both to the planet and to individuals. And then suddenly you have the crash, you have the development of this severe recession across the West, and the left in Europe and elsewhere suddenly start saying, oh, we must challenge austerity. And they don't mean it. They don't mean it at all, because they have been arguing for austerity for a long time. And now what they mean by challenging austerity is basically just propping up the welfare state. They don't have any serious vision for overhauling economic life to make it more productive or anything else. So I found myself in that position, a similar position to you, where I always considered myself on the left. And to my mind, being on the left meant you wanted huge industrial economic growth to liberate people from poverty, and you wanted as few state diktats as possible to liberate people from officialdom. That was my, I don't know if it's an overly romantic, but that was my view of the left, that it was about expanding people's freedom and realizing the human potential. And then for the past few years, when I was getting involved in left-wing politics, all I could hear were lefties saying, oh, we can't allow the working classes to have big houses and fancy cars and everything else because the planet will go up in flames. So it's a real abandonment, I think, of what the left was traditionally about.
In the 90s, everyone I knew on the left was against austerity. I mean, in the sense of being followers of Chomsky and pro-welfare state and pro-social spending, so therefore not for austerity, okay? Because austerity means, for the left anyway, austerity means lack of social spending, but also at the same time against growth. The left was against productive growth in the economy. And the only reason you could hold both positions and not have cognitive dissonance is because you had no – is if you had no conception at all of what – of the economy, of how the economy worked and not what, what the state needed in order to have welfare programs.
Exactly. And also – exactly right. And also the reason they could hold those various positions is because of their utter disconnect from the public. And the more that the left became estranged from ordinary people, from the masses, from everyday human beings, the more they developed this nonsensical idea that it's preferable for the welfare state basically to look after everyone than it is to have disruptive, huge economic growth that would allow people to work and to be self-sufficient. So I'm also deeply concerned about the left's promotion of welfareism in recent years, because I don't think they understand what a trap it can be and how it can undermine both individual initiative, but also, even worse than that, social solidarity, because you encourage people to rely more on the faceless authorities than on their own gumption or on their neighbors or on their friends. I think the left has been complicit in creating a situation where huge numbers of poor people in particular, but also other people, working class people, have been ensnared by this kind of a reliance on the state. And that is really destructive, especially if your aim is to energize working people, make them demand more, make them into this kind of revolutionary mob. If you have any ideas like that, then it's completely bizarre and contradictory to be so pro-welfare state.
Look, we've already agreed that no one is truly revolutionary at this moment, right? Mm. And the only thing I'd point out is that Spike isn't any more than the left that you're talking about, right? I mean, neither one of you have ambitions for a revolutionary project at the moment. I guess my question is, why do you think it is that the left made this turn away from a revolutionary ambition? And how is Spike in it, maybe in its rear guard way, trying to overcome that?
I think there's been a long history of historic defeats. The first thing I should say is I think the left wing is the best political idea human beings have ever had. It is to my mind, it is the ultimate political project in its origins, when it was first around, in the first 100 years or so of its existence. But it's suffered various defeats, historically speaking. But I think a really important turning point was the 1950s and the 1960s and the rise of the new left and the rise of the countercultural movement. Because what you could see around that time were people who considered themselves left-wing quite self-consciously distancing themselves from ordinary people and from everyday society. So all of a sudden, being on the left didn't mean being interested in economic life and people's everyday existences and the need for work and the need for comfort and the need for wealth. Instead, it meant being cool. You know, I don't fall for advertising. I'm not into the consumer society. I'm not vulgar in that way. And slowly but surely, being left-wing meant actually contrasting yourself with ordinary people rather than believing that you had something in common with them and wanted to fight alongside them. So, and that has grown and grown and grown and has morphed into identity politics and everything else, to such an extent now that whenever I meet young lefties, I'm always, you know, in their 20s, I'm always really struck by how they dress and how they have their hair. They always dress in a quite unconventional way. They always have purple or blue hair. They always say things like, oh, you know, McDonald's there. And it's all about, it's all a kind of peacock style, you know, I'm better than everyone else. I don't fall for capitalism and the man. And I don't like the, and so I think that it's a long project. The decline of the left has been a long and ongoing project. But I think the 60s was really significant in terms of shifting the left's focus from economic life to cultural life and from demanding more to basically demanding that everyone just leave us alone and stop pissing us off.
So almost everybody does. But do you think that there's something you can do?
Yeah!
Yeah?
Yeah!
Well, you're wrong. It's just the opposite. In fact, let me tell you all about it.
Everybody should stop doing everything. Everybody should stop doing everything. Everybody should stop doing everything.
Stop,
everybody
stop, stop,
should
what's good for the economy may not be good for you.
And even if you disagree, what about ecology?
There's no car you can drive, there's no product you can buy, there's no content you can throw. All you have to do is lay low.
Everybody should stop doing everything. Everybody should stop doing everything. Everybody should stop doing everything.
Stop it, 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 stop it.
Not to ask you a too personal question, but generally speaking, what generation are you a part of? Are you Gen X or are you a millennial or somewhere in between?
Oh, I'm Gen X. Gen X are the ones who were born between 64 and 75.
Almost 80, I think.
Yeah, I'm Generation X, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, I am too. I was born 1970. And so what's interesting about Generation X is that that's actually a term – I've said this lots of times on my podcast, but I like to bring it up because it's important, I think. That's actually a term that came out of the boomers. It wasn't originally aimed at us, you know. And the whole idea of it was people who were looking for radical change in the world were trying to find the subjective history, and they were abandoning the working class and looking to the creative classes – to be the new subjects of history, people who would abandon the society that needed to be changed and create something new. And they called these new creative classes the Generation X. And that's what, you know, our generation was supposed to be, this new creative class, just by, you know, by luck and circumstance of being born at a certain time. But the logic of, say, hipsterism or the counterculture is the logic of, I guess, the term is escaping me, but the logic of setting up the new society within the old.
Yeah, but the problem I find with the counterculture, I mean, I'm really anti-hippie, which is a shame because I've got some good friends who are hippies in the 60s. They're really nice people, but I'm anti-hippie, and because my problem with the counterculture and the new left is, not firstly, that it kind of shifted the left in a really strange, worrying direction, and eventually nurtured generational politics and identity politics and all these other destructive, very divisive forms of politics. But also, I think the counterculture has quite ironically proved to be quite authoritarian, because the whole idea behind the counterculture is, it was like a shift from, you know, in John Stuart Mill's era, you had this idea of the robust individual who was capable of hearing everything and experiencing everything and coping with it. Mm-hmm. Then what you have with a counterculture is the development of this new idea of the fragile individual. All alone in the world, you know, the man is out to get you, advertising is bombarding you, everything around you is going to harm you or try and tempt you, and you have to resist it as much as possible or hide away from it. Really giving rise to this idea of the kind of diminished individual, diminished autonomy. It's you on your own, and you've just got to do your best to survive. And I think it's out of that we get the whole kind of therapeutic culture, the increasing psychic interventions into people's minds and lives, the idea that all of us require this kind of official scaffolding to cope with everyday life. So it's really ironic, I think, that the counterculture emerges as this kind of ostensibly as a strike for freedom and a blow for freedom, particularly cultural freedom. But it then morphs over the decades into what we have now, I think, which is the very mainstream idea years off, firstly, the new media feminism, which is the idea that men's behavior is problematic and needs to be controlled, the therapeutic culture, which is the idea that we're all fragile and screwed up, and environmentalism, which is the idea that everything we do leaves a horrible, dirty, rotten skid mark on the planet and we've got to stop acting. So all those post-countercultural trends really bear down on the individual today and send the message to us, you know, just stop doing stuff. And I think that's really destructive and really utterly against the spirit of what the left used to be about.
We've gone from looking for the new subject of history to trying to escape subjectivity altogether. Like, just do you think that's what's going on? Just trying to be natural or sort of like the same as the objects in the world? Is that what we're doing?
Definitely. There's unquestionably a crisis of subjectivity or just a lack of belief in the existence of subjectivity. You just need to look at the way in which people talk about freedom of speech, for example, or more importantly, free will. You know, people now openly call into question the idea of free will. And we're seeing the rise of all these new forms of determinism, historical determinism, the idea that, you know, black kids at universities, if they see a statue of a colonialist, they will collapse into a puddle of trauma, you know, parental determinism, the idea that how you're parented in the first 5 years of your life determines the rest of your future, genetic determinism, of course, all these new forms of determinism, which I think are really interesting because what they speak to is the idea that there isn't any real human subjectivity and we are just objects who are shaped by our surroundings and battered by our surroundings. You know, words wound us, parents screw us up, our genes determine whether we're going to be right-wing or homosexual or a music player or a criminal. Every message we get today, I think, from both officialdom and academia and mainstream thinkers is that there's very little you can do to control your path in life. So I think, yes, absolutely, we're moving into an era of kind of post subject thinking, and that's one of the things that's really important to challenge, and I hope Spiked plays some role in that, in just really restating the argument that human beings have it within their capacity both to determine their own futures as they see fit, but more importantly to determine the future of society itself.
To what extent do you think the problem is intellectual today, meaning this, like when it comes to something like free will? That is a long-term philosophical problem that I don't think has ever been properly settled. You know, I can sort of gesture towards the philosophers who might deal with the question of free will more effectively than others, but I can't say that there's a knockdown argument for free will or that free will as a philosophical concept is necessarily even entirely coherent. Certainly, it's not if you are just using the everyday kind of thinking about free will. So how much of this could be worked out in the realm of philosophy, do you think?
I think a lot of it is, it can be worked out or explained through the realm of ideas and philosophy. I think ideas have a huge impact on society and on the way in which society organizes itself and on the way in which people understand their everyday experiences. So I think it's extremely important to engage in the battle of ideas. You know, one of the problems I have with the left, and particularly when I was younger, when I was in my late teens, my early 20s, I knew I was left wing and I was looking to join some kind of left wing group. And so much of the left was just interested in economics in a really bovine way. You know, they were economic determinists effectively and blamed everything on the economic realm and not in an interesting Marxist way at all, just in a very strange deterministic fashion. And I was always thinking, well, you know, we got to think about the ideas. We got to think about the way in which people think. We got to think about the way in which society conceives of itself and the impact that has on the people who live in that society. So I think a lot of it can be explained and then hopefully fought over in on the kind of moral battlefield of ideas and philosophy. But in relation to free will, I would just say that, you know, I think most people will have had the experience that they are in control of their lives and their decision making. Now, sometimes, obviously, they have to make decisions they wouldn't make if they had every choice under the sun. But people are capable of determining their destinies. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's important to go back even further than the origins of the left, you know, back to the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, because it's really then they have the emergence of the idea that people are not determined by fate. You know, you can push back against fate. You can determine your own destiny. We need to recover that idea, because otherwise, I think, we're going to give rise to a pretty depressing society full of objects who think that they are being determined by their surroundings rather than subjects who want to remake their surroundings in order to make them better.
Well, you said something a minute ago about how determinism makes people think that they are easily wounded and that they can be harmed by a statue of a colonialist and that kind of thing. And I understand sort of intuitively what you're talking about, but it doesn't make a lot of sense if you really don't believe in free will to worry very much about being wounded, because what happened, you don't have free will, so whatever reactions you have were already determined. Everything, there's only one path, and there's no use struggling one way or another about it.
Freedom of the will, I think we're stuck pretty much where Descartes was. We just can't abandon believing it. It's our most immediate, phenomenologically obvious impression. But we can't explain it. And as he said, if there's something which we just know to be true and we don't have any explanation for it, well, too bad for our explanatory possibilities. But I don't see any way of getting around that. I mean, there's a lot of arguments that we don't have freedom of the will. And those arguments, there's a ton of literature on that. And the literature is kind of interesting, actually, for reasons that William James discussed. He said, if you believe that there's no freedom of the will, why bother presenting an argument? You're forced to do it. The person you're talking to can't be convinced because there's no such thing as reasons. So why not watch a baseball game? That wasn't his example. But, you know, anybody who denies freedom of the will actually believes that it's there. Otherwise, they wouldn't bother presenting reasons. I mean, unless they say, look, I'm just forced to present these. I can't do anything else but present these reasons. Which is, yeah. And it's very, very odd, at least, discussions, many of them.
The thing that strikes me about all of this is that it's like, you know, for thousands of years, human beings struggle in various different ways to escape constraints, to escape the idea that someone else needs to shape their life for them, to escape the idea that God is determining everything in their lives. You know, in hugely different ways, either through individual action or through mass action, human beings have struggled against that really repressive idea that they are not or should not be in control of their lives. So I find it really worrying that now, in recent decades, you've seen a complete flip reversal of that. And among those, particularly among those who consider themselves progressive or left-wing or liberal, the opposite argument is now being made, which is that it's too scary to run your own life, or it's impossible, or you don't have free will anyway, so you had better let this army of experts come in and advise you on every aspect of your life, how you raise your children, how you spend your money, what you eat, how many times you exercise. You know, if you read Kant's What is Enlightenment, it's amazing to reread that now, because it's basically just a polemic against the nanny state. That's what it is, you know, not to be historically illiterate about it. But he complains about the fact that he's got a physician who tells him what to eat. He's got a book that thinks for him. He talks about people being tied to the apron strings of all these experts or physicians or philosophers and everyone else. And he says, cut the strings, go it alone. And he says, yes, it's really difficult, but it's so rewarding because you will be free and you'll be able to determine your own destiny. So it's that kind of spirit we need to recover. And I think we need to do it more urgently now than ever before, precisely because of this idea that we don't have free will, that everything wounds us, and that we are basically robots.
Let's pretend for just a moment, and this is really, and believe me, there are many women who will tell you this. This is really not the case, but let's pretend for a moment that I'm a feminist, okay? And I say to you, look, you've got it all wrong. We don't think of ourselves as powerless. We don't think we're unable to control our lives. We think you men are stepping up and doing too much and need to step back and allow us to have more political power, and we're making a demand for more political power for ourselves as women.
I don't buy that. I think the new feminism was vaguely interesting when it first came. I mean, the second wave of feminism in the 60s and 70s was quite interesting. I think it was always problematic because it misinterpreted the problems of society as problems of male behavior, which meant that it became this kind of very moralistic campaign quite quickly, rather than being any kind of true left-wing revolutionary campaign to reimagine or remake society itself. So there's always been a problem with feminism. But the new feminism that we've seen explode over the past 4 or 5 or 6 years is really problematic, I think, because it's driven primarily by victim culture. So
I just got to interrupt you. It's really problematic, aren't you, using their language?
I've got to stop using that word. It's really rubbish, I should say, because it's driven by victim culture. It's driven by a view of women as fragile and as not enjoying the same level of moral autonomy as men, which is presumably why, the new feminists want images of naked women to be banned, or they want pop songs on campuses to be banned, or they're always calling for speech codes and the control of language and the control of wolf whistles and everything else, because it's assumed that the public realm is too rowdy and gruff for women to be able to negotiate it on their own. Now, of course, that was precisely the idea that the early feminists argued against, which was the idea that university was too scary for women and the streets were too scary for women and the workplace was certainly too scary for women. Feminists said, no, we can do this. Let us do it. And now you have the reversal of that argument, a new feminist saying, well, you know, the streets are really dangerous. Universities are full of jocks and lads who want to touch our bums. This real kind of...
That last bit is absolutely true, though. That last bit is 100% correct. The universities are full of men, lads, who would like to touch their bums. Hopefully, some of them want to have their bums touched.
Yeah. I think, but the problem is that if you look at campus feminism in particular, it's really weird. I mean, firstly, they wildly exaggerate the level of sexual threat that students, female students,
sure,
face. They just massively exaggerate. They collapse together everything from rape, incidents of rape, which every normal person thinks is horrific, with unwanted sexual advances, for example, which can just mean being approached in a bar and offered to have a drink bought for you. So they mix together all sorts of different criminal and social experiences. And what they do in the process, I think they do demonize men. They demonize these young men who, you know, and many of them probably are sexually stupid and not very good at negotiating sex life. But, you know, they're hardly rapists. So I think that speaks to how divisive the new post-counterculture politics is, which is that it's constantly obsessing over how individuals behave and speak to each other and has hardly anything to say about the broader problem of how society, the economy, or thinking is organized today.
When you start to critique, say, the culture of political correctness that's taken hold on campuses and point out some of the inaccuracies in the rhetoric around, say, sexual assaults or rapes on campuses, you can be very clear and be supported by the facts and yet end up taking a position that I think that you want to avoid. For instance, when there are claims that male sexuality is demonized, it gets almost to the level where you're saying we men are being oppressed.
Oh, no.
By this culture of political correctness, and we need to be liberated, and, you know, we need laws changed.
Men's rights activists are the saddest people on the planet. I mean, if there was a rogues gallery of victim culture losers, they would be, you know, at the very top. I think they are sad and pathetic, and they reproduce the worst aspects of feminism, but just in a male with a male focus. It's really sad and creepy. So I don't think men are oppressed. I don't think men need special rights. I don't think they're having a hard time, because I think actually poor white men are having a hard time, and no one cares about that. But that, I think, is a class thing, even if it's justified in a new way these days than it would have been in the past. But I don't think it's a male thing. So men's rights activists are pathetic, but I do think there is a demonization of sexuality in general. I think it, particularly male sexuality, and I don't think this is coming from women. I think it's coming from feminists and from politicians who exploit feminism to push through pretty conservative policies that they would want to push through anyway. And I think one consequence of that is certainly true that young men are encouraged to see themselves as pretty dangerous sexual creatures. And the flip side of that is women are encouraged to see themselves as vulnerable creatures. And I think that's bad for both sides. And it's bad for men because it makes them uncertain of how to negotiate the realm of sex. And it's bad for women on campuses in particular, because it encourages them to think that being chatted up or bought a drink or you know, have an arm thrown around their shoulder is potentially some form of abuse. I think it's just deeply, deeply misanthropic. I don't believe in misandry. I think that's nonsense, and those men's rights activists should go away. But I do think it's misanthropic. It's anti-human. It's divisive. It poisons relations between sexes, between people. It makes everyone think twice before they talk, before they engage, before they dance, before they drink. It's just horrible and antisocial and misanthropic. And I don't think it's coming 100% from feminists. So this is not a kind of anti-feminist thing as such. But I do think feminism is part of a broader trend today which tells us that we cannot trust ourselves and we cannot trust other people. And my argument all the time is, well, how are you going to rebuild society and make it a better place if you don't even trust the guy sitting next to you on the bus or the girl in your class at college? We need to push aside all these misanthropes who would encourage us not to trust each other.
Okay, so now I wanted to talk about free speech, you know, directly here, and ask you why is it for Spiked and for you, why is free speech sort of the central plank in your platform, say?
I think it's the most important issue of our times, because freedom of speech is the foundational freedom. Without freedom of speech, you can't. The right to vote means nothing, because how can you spread your political ideas if you don't have complete freedom? Artistic freedom means nothing unless you're able to paint or film or write about anything you want. All those everyday freedoms that we take for granted and we expect are all underpinned by the idea that we should be free to say and write and speak as we please. So it's the foundational freedom. And I think it's undermining today, whether it's on campuses or whether it's through hate speech laws in Europe or whether it's through Twitter mobs who use extreme pressure to make people retract statements and so on, all these various means through which free speech is undermined. That, I think, is driven by the thing we were just talking about, which is this very misanthropic idea that people are either evil or fragile, and therefore either need to be shut up or need to be protected. So it creates this vast system of authoritarianism and discourages people from being honest, from having discussions, from working out for themselves what they think is the best way to run their lives.
Descartes wanted to be able to doubt everything so that he could get to the truth, and I think the really radical free speech advocates want to be able to say or think anything for the same reasons, with kind of a trust that once something is said, that it can be interpreted and more can be said, and that we can work out in a free and open way what the truth actually is and what the best ways for it are.
And John Stuart Mill makes a similar point, which is the only way you can ever really find out the truth of something, or at least approach the truth of something, is through having as open and free and full and rigorous a public discussion as possible, with no censorship and no ideas being shoved to one side as too bad. The thing is, you know, when you have students, for example, who kind of are retreating into their safe spaces where, you know, certain words can't be said and certain ideas can't be expressed, the people, I mean, they're damaging two people. Firstly, they're damaging the people who hold those ideas, who are implicitly told you're not welcome here, and in fact, who can have pressure and force used against them to keep them out of these safe spaces. So that it's bad for those guys who just happen to hold unpopular views. But it's even worse for the people in the safe space. It's such a trap because they're making themselves stupid. They're making themselves ignorant through refusing to engage with ideas or imagery or speech that makes them feel uncomfortable. Because only through doing that that you improve, as Mill called them, your own mental and moral muscles, because you test out your own ideas, you engage, you argue, and you give yourself the freedom to change your mind. These people are denying themselves the freedom to change their mind, which means that all the things they hold to be true are actually just like religious dogmas. They just know they're true in some magical way. They haven't actually proved that they're true through public debate. So they're really they're censoring people who are unpopular, which is a really bad thing to do. But even worse is they are destroying their own autonomy and their own soul and their own ability to become better people through either getting better at articulating their beliefs or changing their beliefs.
How does multiculturalism or relativism buttress this anti-speech position, this sort of safe space mentality? Can you tell me what the connection is there between relativism and multiculturalism and this illiberal response to new ideas or ideas that don't fit within your worldview?
Yeah, it seems like a contradictory thing, which is that we live in these really very relativistic multicultural times in which, you know, the rallying cry is, you know, don't judge anyone, all cultures are equally valid, all that kind of nonsense, which is not true. You know, some cultures are better than others. But, you know, you're not supposed to judge, you're not supposed to be harsh, let everyone say and do whatever they want. That seems to be the organizing principle of 21st century Western society. But at the same time, things feel very authoritarian, people are censoring themselves or they're being censored by others. And I think that's because there's a real, you know, there's an iron fist of authoritarianism in this velvet glove of relativism and multiculturalism, which is that, you know, if you say all cultures are not equally valid, you will be attacked. If you say, I don't want to be a relativist, I want to judge things, I want to be harsh on things, I want to criticize things, you will be attacked. So it's this weird thing where we're supposed to be all these kind of, you know, hippie-ish people, Oprah Winfrey-style people who say, you know, I don't mean to judge and I'm not going to judge, but we judge judgment and we criminalize judgment and we come down like a ton of bricks on anyone who expresses a morally superior viewpoint. So I think multiculturalism plays a key role in the self-censorship of the 21st century through discouraging any expression of an idea that one culture or one way of life might just be better than another. That's the big no-no of our times. That's the thing you're really not allowed to say.
If you truly believe that all values and all cultures are equally justified, then you don't trust people to be able to reason or interpret what the best approach is. And so in order to protect your view and yourself, you just want to cut your ideas off from other forces because they might overwhelm you, not through any process of reason or justifiable interpretation, but by force. And so you're basically putting up defensive walls and buttressing your position through force. When everything's equal, then all discourse is just a war.
Exactly. And also, it's really destructive socially as well, I think, because if you look at Europe at the moment, I mean, I'm about as pro-freedom of movement as it's possible to get, which is really handy, actually, because it means that all these right-wing people who think they love Spike suddenly will balk and think, what? They're in favor of freedom of movement. They can't really handle it. So I'm in favor of freedom of movement. However, I do think the influx of migrants from Syria and Afghanistan and other places that we've seen over the past year is a problem, not because the migrants are a problem, but because of the societies they are coming to, which are societies which refuse to elevate their own values over any others, which refuse to say that their way of life is a good way of life and that people coming to their nation should aspire to join it. You know, the kind of things that New York said in the 19th century or London said with the kind of influx of black migrants in the 1950s, it was like, you know, this is a good place to live. We're democratic, we're free, although that wasn't always the case. And you should join us and become part of this nation. And so I'm always struck by the fact that if you look at, you know, I sometimes speak to young British Muslims on campus, and, you know, the young girls have all got the veils on and the young guys are all wearing smocks and kind of Islamic dress. But their parents and their grandparents who came to Britain, they didn't dress like that. They aspired to be part of Western society. They worked in it. They became part of it. So something strange is happening where one of the problems with multiculturalism is that by disallowing any kind of statement of cultural superiority or the idea that Western democratic enlightened society is better than an Islamic theocratic society, for example, by refusing to allow that, you give a green light to people to move into ethnic ghettos, to move into cultural ghettos, to maintain their own cultural practices safe in the knowledge that no one will ever criticize them. So I think it's extremely divisive. And again, it runs against one of the core principles of what it used to mean to be on the left, which was universalism. The idea that we all have something in common, you know, the common man, that was the great thing. Now the left is entirely obsessed with basically stoking up division through saying, well, you guys live over there, you guys live over there, you guys live over there. No one is allowed to criticize any aspect of your culture. So the left, that's another example, I think, of how the left has turned completely on its head its traditional values, moving from celebrating the universal ideals to celebrating the particularism of people's experiences.
So, yeah, I'm glad you brought all of this up, and you said quite a lot here, but I want to bring out something that you wrote in your recent essay on this subject about the immigration crisis and the Syrian refugees and the attendant sexual assaults that occurred on New Year's Eve in Cologne, Germany, which is, you wrote that what's happening is the refugees are arriving into a culture and they're sensing that their new countries have no serious value system of their own. And that I'm reminded of this line from the Communist Manifesto, which is that all that is solid melts into air. And I would say that we live in a system or in a culture which finds it very difficult to hold on to cultural values because these values are constantly changing as the base demands, as the economy demands. And so that's the culture that where you find the real value is in the economy and in a way of producing the world rather than in a way of a more human operations. You know, the whole idea is that we live in an alienated culture. Marx's critique of bourgeois culture is that it's an alienated culture because of the economy. So wouldn't we need to overcome that in order to – wouldn't we have to have some sort of future vision? And then the other thing I'll say is that the difficulty with the multiculturalist relativist view is that it has no purchase on a future on any kind of value system that it would like to see replace what we have.
Yeah, I think certainly the way in which the economy is organized is atomizing and alienating and has an impact on how people live and how they experience their existences. That's all true. But it's nonetheless possible to cohere even within those kind of societies, those kind of economies. It's still possible to cohere people around a social vision and a moral vision or a political vision. I always think, you know, I often come up against people who say to me, you know, we can't possibly have all these Muslims in Europe or all these Africans in Europe because you can't have too many different cultures living together. And I always say to them, well, look at New York City. You know, you can walk from Koreatown to Chinatown to Little Island to Little Italy. I mean, every culture is just thrown together into this island and it works. And not only does it work, but it's a wonderful place and loads of people would like to live there. And that happened at a time when capitalism was far more brutal than it is now. You know, when people were exploited to an extraordinary degree, and work was not safe, and the working life was extremely difficult and disruptive. Even in those conditions, people managed to create a city, you know, not without its tensions and its violence and its riots and everything else, but they managed to birth a city in which there is an overarching vision. You know, I'm a New Yorker. And then, oh yeah, and I'm also an Italian, I'm also Irish, and I'm also a Muslim, but I'm a New Yorker. So it's that overarching vision which is absent. And I don't think you necessarily have to, you know, move from capitalism to socialism in order to fix that. I think there's something else going on. And I think what it really speaks to is the West's loss of faith in the values upon which it was founded. And this, I think, is coming back to your point earlier. This is where I think the battle of ideas is incredibly important, because the West is not only is it losing the battle of ideas, but it's vacating the battlefield. It's just become increasingly reluctant to stick a flag on that battlefield and to say, we are this, it is good, this is what we're all about. It just doesn't want to do that anymore. So my view of multiculturalism is that it's making a virtue of a vacuum. It's a kind of sexed up term to describe actually the West's loss of faith in its own culture. But of course, Western leaders can't go around saying we've lost faith in the Enlightenment. So instead, we've seen the rise of this new ideology of multiculturalism, which says all cultures are good. So it's a slippery, dishonest, slightly Orwellian idea to put a gloss on the fact that the real problem we face today is that the left and the right, all sides in Western society, have massively lost faith in the great ideals that people fought and died for.
Hear me. Hear this! Among my people, we carry many such words as this from many lands. Many worlds, many are equally good and are as well respected. But wherever we have gone, no words have said this thing of importance in quite this way. Look at these three words written larger than the rest, with a special pride never written before or since. Tall words proudly saying, we the people. That which you called Ede Plebnista was not written for the chiefs, or the kings, or the warriors, or the rich, or the powerful, but for all the people. Down the centuries, you have slurred the meaning out of the words, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty. Ourselves and our posterity to ordain and establish this Constitution, these words and the words that follow were not written only for the Yangs, but for the Coms as well.
The Coms?
They must apply to everyone or they mean nothing. Do you understand?
I do not fully understand. One named Kirk. But the holy words will be obeyed. I swear it.
No question about his guilt, Captain. But does our involvement here also constitute a violation of the Prime Directive?
We merely showed them the meaning of what they were fighting for. Liberty and freedom have to be more than just words. Doctor. Gentlemen, the fighting is over here. I suggest we leave them to discover their history and their liberty.
Do Do you think that in order to return to the traditional Enlightenment values, which have, you know, which puts a lot of faith in human subjectivity to and free speech and reason in order to interpret the world and create new ways of living, do you think that in order to accomplish this, we may not need to overcome capitalism, but we may need at least to start holding on to that ambition, that we may need at least some sort of future vision that can see beyond the state of affairs that we have now?
Yeah, not necessarily. I think my take would be, you know, I got involved in politics in order to get rid of capitalism, you know, when I was a kind of 17-year-old reading Trotsky, and it was all very exciting. But now I think things are really different. The problem we face now is actually, this is going to sound really weird, but the problem, one of the problems we face now is all the restraints on capitalism, and the idea that capitalism has gone too far and built too much and industrialized too much of the earth and polluted too much of the air. No, I'm sorry, but when 2 billion people still live in dire poverty, that is a repulsive argument. That is an anti-human argument. So when I hear Westerners, left-wingers in the West with their iPhones campaigning against industrial growth in China or arguing for just sustainable development in Africa, which is the biggest con in history, I feel like, you know, sometimes I feel like actually smacking them, because these are really, this is like pulling up the drawbridge. We've had our ugly, violent industrial revolution, but you can't have yours. So my problem, I think that the real problem we face today is that there are too many people trying to bring capitalism down and to make it less of a kind of growing, forceful thing. And I would say that the responsibility of people who consider themselves progressive now is actually to challenge anti-capitalism, mainstream anti-capitalism, which in my view is anti-economic growth, it's anti-third world, it's misanthropic, it's anti-consumerism, it's anti-wealth creation, it sacralizes the planet at the expense of human beings. All those backward trends, which I think we've seen growing right from the anti-globalization movement of the late 1990s, through the Green movement, through the anti-war movement, through the Occupy movement, which I'm not a fan of at all, we've seen the development of an anti-capitalism which is really backward and romantic and problematic, to use that terrifying word. I think those of us who consider ourselves progressive and radical and all those other things now need to challenge the arguments against capitalism, because right now they are worse than capitalism itself.
I said I was going to only ask you one last thing, and I'll stick to that. But I do have to say one thing in response to that, which is just this. The idea that the what's constraining capitalist development is some blue-haired hippies on college campuses is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, and that it, especially after the economic crisis of 2008, clearly what's constraining capitalism is its own tendency to go into crisis,
yeah,
and not any political campaign.
Okay? I agree with that, but I would say that those blue-haired hippies on campus, I've always argued that they are only the external expression of capitalism's own loss of faith in itself. I think the problem is that with capitalism is firstly it's ongoing, constant, never-ending structural contradictions, which is important to understand, but also it's lost faith in its own bourgeois project of remaking the world in its own image. So all those kind of idiots who storm into Starbucks or demand that people pay their tax or you know, go on campus and say, down with capitalism, they think they're being revolutionary and radical, but they are only expressing in more colorful terms capitalism's own loss of faith in its project.